course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But hold your calls for the time being. We have with us in studio one of my favorite guests, Joan Paris, and on the line back from Maryland, where it's pushing the butching hour, Joan Vion. And we're going to be talking about, well, what are we going to be talking about tonight, Joan Vion?
Ask Joan Paris.
All right, Joan Paris, what are we going to be talking about tonight?
Well, Dr. Stan, I am really excited because I just read the latest newsletter from Joan Vion, and of course she just came back from the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. And and this newsletter, if she put it into a booklet, she'd have a nice little book right here. So in the next 2 hours, we're going to cover her topic of the reform of the United Nations. And at some point, I wanted to talk about, I'm going to interject some things, but I also wanted to talk about the inaugural address that we heard a month ago, and how that brings it down to us, and how we're seeing all of this implemented, and how the president is telling us that he's implementing this global agenda.
Okay, that sounds good to me. How about you, Joan?
Sounds good to me.
All right, fine. Well, then why don't you, who's going to take off? Joan Vion, why don't you take off?
For many of your listeners, you probably know that I have covered 65 global meetings in the last 10 years. And what we have seen, in my opinion, is we have seen the whole structure of world government come into play. The IMF, World Bank, United Nations, the World Trade Organization, the International Criminal Court, and as a result of 9/11, the most serious and sensitive barriers between the nation states have fallen, and those are the intelligence and the military. Because the United Nations started holding mega conferences in the early 90s, they did in the 70s, but very, very few people attended. But in the 90s is when their conferences really took hold. And in 1992, most people obviously are familiar with the Rio Earth Summit Agenda 21 and Sustainable Development, the Biological Diversity Treaty. That is where the United Nations perverted Genesis 1. And everything that has happened since then has been a complete philosophical change throughout the 90s and now into the 21st century based around Agenda 21. The goal, obviously, Agenda 21 is the control of all the resources of the planet, including you and I. With regard to the most recent report that I just got from the printers yesterday, it is a 14-page report on the reform of the United Nations, which is called A More Secure World, Our Shared Responsibility. And that report was issued December 2nd by the United Nations. What is so important about this report is that it will bring together many different facets of the whole United Nations philosophy. It will bring together the Agenda 21. It will bring together the Millennium Development Summit and the Millennium Development Goals. And it is, if you will, the new philosophy to integrate all the countries of the world in one final swoop philosophically, because they already have the whole structure set up.
Now, if I could just intervene, and I'm going to let then Joan Paris come in, but for our listeners out there who don't understand, there has been a plan for literally thousands of years to create a world government. It goes back to Nimrod, Babylon, certainly Alexander the Great. All of these people were part and parcel of this continuity of effort to create a world government, but never before in all recorded time has there been a time like this when everything is coming together. These people know exactly what they're doing. There is a small elite group who want a world fascist system under their control, that are using the military and financial power of the United States government to bring that about. While our attention is focused on what's going on over in Iraq, while our focus our attention is focused on other issues, why they are moving us towards a fascist society here in America, a surveillance society in the name of fighting terrorism, but in the process, as Joan has said, why they have the World Court and the World Parliament and moving towards a world army and towards a world tax. All of these things are taking place, but they can't let the American people know any more than they can let the people of the rest of the world understand what is really happening, because most people want to maintain their national sovereignty. They want to maintain their freedom. They don't want a world fascist society. But you see, this small group of very powerful and wealthy men do have an agenda, and of course much of this is laid out in Agenda 21, which is really the agenda for the 21st century that's being enacted today. Joan Paris, pick up.
Well, and I, like you say, the Agenda 21, and to bring that right down to the local level, that's moving people out of their cars, it's removing lanes from our roads, it's prohibiting the way people use their private property, it's dumbing down the children in our schools, it's dictating what the size of your family will be, how many children you can have, and now with the mental health assessments and you know, tracking our children from, you know, the very beginning, indoctrinating them and tracking them into how they will serve the government, what career they will have. All of these freedoms that we enjoy are being taken away. And isn't it interesting that in President Bush's inaugural address, he said that freedom, I mean, basically he raises freedom to the level of God by saying that it is the most powerful force that there is in the world.
And you know, it's very interesting with that idea of freedom being the most powerful voice. The question is, how do you define freedom? Because in his inaugural speech, he...
Oh, hold on right there. All right. Well, with us, of course, is Joan Vian from Maryland. And, of course, Joan Paris from... Right, well, she's right here in studio. And Joan Vian is saying... How was it that President Bush defined freedom in his inaugural speech? Certainly, he talks a great deal about freedom as he takes freedom away from the American people. He talks about cutting the budget as he increases federal spending. He talks about bringing democracy to Iraq and the Middle East and other countries in the world. Why would he do that when America is a Republican? He knows that democracy always leads eventually to despotism. Plato wrote that in the Republic almost, 2,500 years ago. Well, maybe the president never read what Plato said in the Republic. Democracy always degenerates to despotism. Is that what we're really bringing to the rest of the world? Despotism? Go ahead.
Well, it goes back to how you define freedom.
Exactly. And you know, Joan would say that freedom comes from God. And isn't it interesting that in the Charter of the United Nations, freedom and dignity are given by man, are granted by men in man-made institutions. And in this speech, it's freedom that's being provided by a government, not from God.
But it's also freedom that is provided by a government who says that they know better than all the other countries of the world.
Right.
And that whatever freedom those countries have isn't good enough, because Bush says that the U.S. policy is to make, quote, every nation and culture democratic, unquote. And so when you start taking a look at that, I mean, just today we had North Korea say, hey, we have the bomb and we're not going to be afraid to use it.
Isn't that interesting that came out today? Because they, you know, I mean, if you read the policy for the new American century and some of the other reports that have come out from the United States, they list the countries that are the greatest problem and the ones that they'll be looking at for possible future intervention. And on those lists, you'll find North Korea. But wasn't it the State of the Union address where North Korea was taken off the charts? And then this comes out today. So obviously we're being toyed with.
Now, we're being told one thing, and they really intend another. Certainly, Condoleezza Rice has said, we are not going to attack Iraq. That means we are going to attack Iraq, because everything is just the opposite from what they say. They say one thing, they do another.
Well, you know, it's very interesting when you take a look at the Arab world, because if he says every nation and culture democratic, then the bottom line is What if your neighbor is not democratic? In order to be democratic, you have to have the country next to you democratic, so that you know, there's not going to be quote unquote any war because the country next to you is not democratic. So when you look at the Arab world, it stretches from Morocco to the western border of Iran, and there's 6 million square miles of that whole area that Bush basically is saying he's going to democratize.
And you know, it's interesting, Joan, in his speech, he says that democracy is the only way to protect minorities. Well, democracy is nothing more than the scenario in The Lord of the Flies where the majority rules. So it's just the complete opposite of that. It's really amazing.
Well, what is really scary, Joan and Dr. Stan, is the fact that when you look at the reform of the United Nations, and this all, I think there's all, you know, the same thread running in all of this. When you look at the United Nations, and of course, let's remember that without the United States, there would be no United Nations. When you look at the United Nations, and the bottom line in the whole philosophy of the reform of the United Nations is something called collective security. And this is a brand new term that has been evolving for a while. And collective security is based on, it goes back to the Charter of the United Nations, and it basically says that, hey, look, collective security means that we are going to intervene in a country and we are going to ensure for humanitarian purposes that the world is at peace, that there is no more civil war, there is no interstate war, there is no war between states, and in addition to that, it's not enough that there's no war, we are going to also fight poverty, we are going to fight disease, HIV, AIDS, and malaria and smallpox, we are going to fight ignorance such as every child should have a basic education. We are going to provide safe drinking or clean drinking water for everybody in the world. And we are going to reduce the mortality of children under 5 dying by 66%. And
you know,
so it's all humanitarian purposes, and that also includes natural disasters.
Well, I remember, of course, the First World War. That was the war to end all wars. We weren't going to have any more wars after that. The other slogan was the war to make the world safe for democracy. The war to make the world safe for democracy almost sounds just like the present administration, doesn't it?
Well, and all those things sound great because we would all love to see a world without poverty and a world with all of these things. But what does the United Nations and its partners need to do to accomplish that, Joan? It sounds like they'd have to put a global straitjacket on the world. Don't you have a book by that name?
I do. That's why I called it Global Straitjacket. I saw that what is really coming through this planned, managed society in which freedom comes from government and not God, where our freedoms are numbered and can be taken away versus inalienable without number and can never be taken away. They are ours forever.
I think it was so interesting that in the recent election over in Iraq, there were many of the Christians were not allowed to vote. They just didn't have any place for them to vote. They were not allowed to vote. Some of them had gone up into Kurdistan, and they wouldn't allow them to vote. There just weren't any ballots for them. It was almost as if the one group that was targeted not to be allowed to vote in the Iraqi elections was the Christians. Why would a Christian administration in charge of that election really discriminate against the Christians of Iraq, the Coptic Christians and the Syrian Christians of Iraq, and make sure that they would not have any representation or very little representation in this new government? Yet lots of strange things are going on in the world today. Anybody like that article? We do have it in the New York Times. And, of course, the Christians seem to have been targeted there by our Christian administration.
You know, Dr. Stan, I have a client who is a Syrian, which is what the Christians from that region are called, and in the whole run-up to this process, which has been going on for a couple of years, I became interested in finding out about these peoples because I knew nothing about them, and they were cut out from the very beginning from any representation, from any dialogue in the government. There has been no meaningful representation whatsoever for the Assyrian Christians.
You mean the Christian Bush administration didn't give the Christians in Iraq a voice?
I'm afraid not.
But they certainly gave it to the Shia Muslims and the Kurds and to the Sunni Muslims. I guess it's just the Christians they forgot about.
Well, and it can be the Christians from Assyria. It can be the Christians in Rwanda. It can be the Christians in Kosovo and Bosnia. It always seems to be the Christians that are targeted for elimination.
And, of course, we were the ones who were backing the Muslims in Kosovo, and we were the ones who were backing the Muslims in Bosnia, and both of those groups, incidentally, were related to Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda. Why were we backing them in Kosovo and Bosnia? Is it possible that the perception of what's going on in the world today is really not as it really is?
Yes.
Go ahead, Joan.
Absolutely. You know, it's deceit, it's deception, and it's distortion. And there is a difference between government and country. And I think people need to make that distinction, that the country that we know as America is one entity, and the government that is running it is another entity. And because the government certainly is not operating according to the Constitution.
Amen to that. And of course, I love my country, but I fear my government.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Well, Kirsten, what did you learn there that would tie into this whole situation when you were at the meeting of the World Economic Forum over there in Davos? Because this is where the captains of the kings, the people who control the reins of financial power of the world, were meeting. Did you have a chance to talk to any of these people about this move towards world government?
Well, I remember the first meeting that Joan Parros and I went to, and she got into an argument with a lady coming from the airport because she flatly questioned, what, world government? I mean, are you talking world government? What about sovereignty? And the lady let her know in no uncertain terms is that there was no sovereignty. Is that correct?
That was correct. Gosh, we didn't even get to the summit, and here I was in a debate.
What are you doing, Joan Parros? You want to get us thrown out?
You have to understand, for our listeners out there, that Joan Parros and Joan Vian have gone to a number of these international meetings together where some of the richest and most powerful men in the world are, and then here are these two Joans together. Of course, they're tracking what's going on, getting the information, talking to some of the world leaders, some of the most wealthy and powerful men in the world. And Joan Parros and Joan Vian have talked to both of them, many of them, gathering the information so they can bring it to us. People have to understand we're moving, and moving rapidly, towards world government. And while our attention is focused on bringing freedom to the people of Iraq, we're progressively losing our freedom here at home. Well, we'll be back in just a moment with our two very good friends, Joan Vian, who writes a financial newsletter and publishes material, and we'll get their information out later, and of course Joan Parros, who is an executive here in the Monterey Bay area, and a mother. I don't know really how she does all the things she does. She has her own business and raising a couple of children. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, Joan Parros, go ahead.
Well, you know, I'm actually just going to turn it back to Joan Vian because she really has her thoughts organized in this newsletter. And
you asked me, Dr. Stan, not to butt in, Joan, but you asked me, Dr. Stan, what I learned at the World Economic Forum. The World Economic Forum that I just got back from, which took place a week ago, was my seventh World Economic Forum, my sixth time in Davos because they had one in New York City after the 9/11 bombing, and it was my 65th global meeting. I have seen, as I have covered the World Economic Forums, and what makes, in my opinion, the World Economic Forum one of the most powerful meetings of the world is that it brings together CEOs from America's, from the world's top 1,000 corporations, along with government leaders from the United Nations and countries, as well as now they've added in the last couple of years religious leaders headed up by the former Archbishop of Kerry, former Archbishop of Canterbury, Lord Clifton of Kerry, and the non-governmental organizations. They bring together all these people together for 1 week. And when I first went there, I expected it only to be business economics and some view of, you know, politics. But what I found when I went to my first one was that it really is a major mini United Nations conference, because there they were inundating the CEOs with Agenda 21 and sustainable development and public-private partnership. And I remember going to a workshop in which they flatly talked about the world had too many people and we had to reduce the population.
The world has too many people and they have to reduce the population. Did they tell how they were going to do that?
Back then, I don't believe they specifically talked about how. They were just explaining to all these people who didn't know anything that there were too many people in the world. Now, what I have seen in the last 7 years is that every year they've added more of the agenda. These people have been inculcated for 7 years, the 7 years that I've gone there, but even longer, because the World Economic Forum has been meeting for 34 years. They are a NGO with consultative status at the United Nations, and as such, really, they are a facilitator for world government, bringing in the business aspect, which is part of public-private partnership and the evolution of a global fascist state. Now, this year, what was so fascinating at this meeting is if I could take everything that I have researched in the last 10 years and the things that I have specialized in, whether it's the economics or sustainable development or global taxation or public-private partnership, it all came to an apex in Davos. The report that I just issued, the reform of the United Nations, when I looked at the whole agenda that they had, and what they do at Davos, they have a lot of different speakers. They had Viktor Yushchenko, and they had Jacques Chirac and Tony Blair and Gerard Schroeder and a couple of African countries.
Now, Yushchenko, is this the new premier of the Ukraine?
That is correct.
All right, fine.
That is correct.
He was the man that we put in, and yet the first thing that... Well, this is Dr. Stan, I guess, this evening is Joan Viana, just back from the World Economic Forum held in Davos, where the captains and the kings, the financial and political rulers of the world, and, of course, the ex-Archbishop of Canterbury, representing, of course, the occult world religions, were there. And she was commenting that Viktor Yushchenko, who supposedly was poisoned by the wicked communists or whoever it was the speaker, but people don't recall that he was there was an election in the Ukraine. We didn't like the result of it. We wanted to get our man, who was Yushchenko, in, and so we demanded another election, and amazingly enough, because America asked for another election, why, they had another election, and then our man won. And what was the first thing he did? Why, he was off to pay homage to Putin, Vladimir Putin in Moscow, and pledging his allegiance to the former rulers of the Ukraine. And then, of course, he comes over to Davos to speak as well. So pick up the story there, Joan.
Well, the whole point with regard to the fact is that they have these world rulers, and they come and they speak, and then they have all these workshops. And in the workshops is where they start formulating the ideas and the concepts that they want these people to go back with. And when I looked at all the different workshops is where I saw the parallel to this new reform of the United Nations report. It was the underlying current of the whole conference. Now, had I not read the reform of the United Nations report, I would not have seen it in the agenda. But I saw it there. For example, they did a number of workshops on terrorism. And in the terrorism workshop, they basically discussed that there was no way to catch these terrorists, terrorism was here to stay, that it was going to get worse. They had Ron Noble from Interpol, the International Police Association, that basically said they knew there was going to be another attack. They didn't know when or where, but it was coming. They also predicted a major attack against oil reserves or oil pipelines, and they basically said that was coming. You know, these things to me are almost like red flags, you know, like bring them on,
yeah,
you know,
like,
something
like,
Bush would have said.
Or like maybe we know exactly what's going to happen. I mean, we're able to infiltrate every organization in the world. Except we just haven't been able to infiltrate Al-Qaeda. We can watch people read a newspaper from a satellite and even read the print on the page, but oh, shucks, we can't find Osama bin Laden or any of these other terrorist leaders, or we have a few of them in capture, but of course we never put them on trial, and the question is, why don't we ever put them on trial? Is it, if they were put on trial, they might break out things that would be embarrassing to government leaders, or maybe we don't have them in captivity. Maybe they're all theoretical. We've never actually seen them, but they keep telling us about them. They're the enemy, and of course we have to have more control over our lives to protect ourselves from this enemy.
And people just need to realize that just like the huge environmental agenda, environmentalism was a central organizing principle, something that people can agree on and be used to take away their liberties. Terrorism is another concept that is a very, it uses fear as a central organizing principle to compel people to give up their liberty and their freedom. That was the whole point of the 9/11 bombing.
And, of course, that's exactly what the report from Iron Mountain was back in 1966, saying we've got to have an enemy if we don't have the Russians anymore as an enemy. What do we come up with as an enemy? Maybe we could convince people that they're aliens from outer space. Or, no, let's do something even better. Let's talk about the environmentalism. The environment will be the enemy. We may have to contaminate the whole world, but we'll mobilize the whole world against the real enemy, degradation of the environment.
You know, it's interesting.
Now we've got the terrorists, of course. They're far better than the environment.
It's interesting that you say that, you know, that we no longer have the Russians or the communists. And as Joan pointed out in her newsletter, there's this period of time from 1989 to 2001, when, you know, the Cold War supposedly had ended. But Joan, in your report, you have a synopsis of several reports that led up to this Brahimi report that we picked up when we were at the Millennium Summit in New York in 2000. And one of the reports that you're giving us a synopsis of is Olaf Palme, The Common Security, A Blueprint for Survival. And you point out a quote from that report that says that in view of the current global distribution of economic resources and technological potential, implementation of a worldwide policy of common security must begin with relations between the United States and the Soviet Union, and between NATO and the Warsaw Pact. And when we come back, I'd like to give some examples of just exactly how we are partnering with the Soviet Union this moment.
And of course, Brahimi was the foreign minister of Algeria. We have that Brahimi report in our Millennium Summit syllabus if you really want to read it. This is all, ladies and gentlemen, it's all being laid out. It's all scripted. The plan is for world fascism.
It's scripture. It's scripture, Dr. Stan. They just have a different religion. I think Joan had mentioned some of the people that are on the panel for this More Secured World, Our Shared Responsibility, the whole collective security agenda. And one of them is this Yevgeny Primakov. And he was the former prime minister of the Russian Federation. He was the head of the Russian KGB. And so, Joan, in the report that you're citing from, it just is exactly what has been called for by these global insiders for the last number of decades. And Primakov has recently been hired to work with what was created by ex-Admiral Poindexter's Office of Information Awareness, the TIA, which is another one of these organizations. And what's interesting is that there are all of these subdivisions that are going to be addressed by the Office of Information Awareness, and they include transportation, they include education, and anyway, we can come back and expand upon that. I don't want to get too far off of what you're talking about in Davos, but if a person goes to the website and they look up USIP.org, you'll find a special report for our American civilian police and UN operations. And I know in our community, the United Nations Association is really big, and you will find on the internet under the United Nations site a huge report how the United Nations Association, these little local groups in our communities that are infiltrating our schools and dictating a lot of policies, are also dictating these peace operations for the 21st century, and so they are planning what's going to be going on at this next conference.
I think it's important that the listeners understand that every communist in the world supports this idea of world government. Every socialist in the world supports this idea of world government. Every humanist in the world supports this idea of world government. Almost everybody in the Council on Foreign Relations, Bilderbergers and Trilateral Commission supports this idea of world government, as do the leaders of the Masons, the Theosophists, the Rosicrucians, and all the various secret and occult organizations. There is an agenda. They know exactly what's going on. And the communists and the capitalists are working together. That's why, of course, Gorbachev, a former dictator of Russia, former head of the Soviet KGB, can work so closely with Maurice Strong, who's a multi-billionaire, the number two man in the United Nations behind us. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and let's get back. We've got Dan calling from Spokane. Hi, Dan. Did you have a quick question?
I do. Thanks for having me. Good show tonight. I appreciate it. I was just curious. I guess and your guests are really interesting tonight. I've been interested in knowing sort of looking at the United States government and seeing that it's not really a republic but a democracy and sort of being sort of worried about that. Are your guests more for a theocracy in the United States? Or, God isn't actually coming down and creating and making things, visually happening. Man has to seem to do it through God. What system are they interested in?
All right, that's a good question. What system are you interested in, Joan Parrish?
Well, I like the one we have, the Constitutional Republic.
Constitutional Republic. Joan Vian, what sort of system would you like?
I agree with Joan Parrish, and let me just make mention that I was in a workshop in Davos with the foreign minister from Iraq, from Iran, the new foreign minister-elect from Iraq, as well as it was Joseph Biden and another senator, I forget, and shame on me, I forget, the other one was Republican, and I think it was Orrin Hatch, and it was very interesting that the big thing that they had against Iran is that they have a theocracy, or they have a religious, they have two forms of government, and one is religious. And the religious rulers determine who can run and who can't run. And so Joseph Biden said, you do not have a democracy, and for that reason, you need to change.
Okay, Dan, I think that if you understand that America was created as a republic is a government of law, a democracy is a government of men. We have a government of men today. Let's get our republic back, okay?
Well, I'm not sure that, I think the Constitution, in fact, I teach history and English at the secondary level. And as far as the Constitution is written, it's obviously not a perfect system, but we are a nation of laws as much as we can possibly do it. I don't think on the face of the earth that there's been a government that's been able to do the things that we've been able to do. I mean, it's the greatest experiment thus far on earth. I mean, even Rome pretended to have a republic, yet it ended up being more of a triumvirate and a hierarchical system.
We had a republic at one time. We no longer have a republic. No, we now have a democracy where we have whatever the Congress wants to do, they can. At one time, the 10th Amendment and the 9th Amendment restricted what Congress could do. In fact, they only met for a month or two out of the year, and they had to go home because there was nothing else they could do. Today, there are no restrictions on what the federal government can do. It is establishing a police force across America.
No, that's not true.
All right. Thank you, Dan. Go ahead.
Well, I appreciate Dan's input, but it does illustrate how bizarre this information is. And I myself, when I heard this being talked about, just thought this was nutty. But having been in these meetings and picked up the documents and listened to the people speak, having been able to tape the people from the United States and hear what they're saying, it's totally contrary to what gets out in the controlled media in the United States. I became a believer really fast with a lot of tears and a lot of heartache at first. But, you know, the Frenchman that came to our country observed that America is great because America is good, and if America should cease to be good, she will cease to be great. And we have seen the destruction of the morality and the institutional foundations of this country.
You're speaking of the Tocqueville, who came here about the late 1830s and wrote about 1840.
And so it all gets back to that, you know, the moral values, the spiritual absolutes, the Judeo-Christian ethic that the country was founded upon, and those are being eroded to the point of the total detriment of our nation.
Joan?
Well, I agree. From what I can tell, when the rules and the regulations that we have are guided and dictated by the morality, the integrity, and the honesty of the people who rule over us. And when those people become greedy and they become immoral and they become liars and thieves and robbers, then actually what we have turns into something that we don't want, because there is no morality, there's no real justice.
You know, and this might be a good time to touch upon, you know, the robbers and the greedy. In looking at this, you know, we talk about the United Nations being in charge of the global police state, which they have laid out in this collective security report. In fact, if the gentleman wants to go to the United Nations Secretary General's high-level panel on threats, challenges, and change, he can get this report, A More Secure World, Our Shared Responsibility, and see how the collective police state is lined out. But it's you know, if for no other reason, this should be disturbing to entrust our safety and our freedoms and our liberties to this institution. When you talk about greed, look at what happened in this oil for food scandal. Kofi Annan, in his numbers for the amount of oil that came out of Iraq that was traded in the oils for food is $111 billion. Well, his son and a corporation that he had affiliations with were able to take a 10%, call it a kickback, a skim, whatever you want. I mean, we're talking about billions of and billions of dollars here that have gone astray.
Sounds like Halliburton.
And with the program that's being constructed by the United Nations, what's $111 billion? We're talking about trillions of dollars, aren't we, Joan, with a global tax?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, the whole thing, first of all, let me just interject here when we talk about the United Nations. From my perspective and my research, let me lay the cards on the table. And that is that, from what I have seen, the power behind the United Nations is the British royal family. And that's what I basically said when I wrote my book, Prince Charles, the Sustainable Prince. So I think we need to take a look at how money is being laundered, if you will, from the U.S. through the U.N., and who knows where it's going from there. I mean, this is a major transfer of wealth. And as I proved in a previous newsletter, on the whole of the international level, the Commonwealth countries are able to operate throughout the whole United Nations system, and as such, if they vote with Mother England within the UN, the Commonwealth has 54 votes and America has one. And you can do that with the IMF, the World Bank. They have different votes, and the bottom line is we are voted in every international fora, organization, and agency. We are outvoted by the Commonwealth countries. Furthermore, if you take it one step further, when you look at United Europe is supposed to compete with America, and so they're bringing together all these individual states, making them one. They have their own currency, they have their own parliament, it's a free trade zone, on and on and on. Bottom line is, America's had that for years, and yet we only get one vote at the UN. The European Union still gets 25 votes at the United Nations, and every single one of those states, you know, they still get their own vote instead of getting one vote for the EU and one vote for the US. So, I mean, you know, the whole scale is tipped. And when we start taking a look at where the money's going, these people are appointed. There's a lot of graft and corruption. They don't have to account to anyone.
Well, I think the interesting thing is, Joan, that as you pointed out earlier, this whole thing really is a product of the people who control America. There would be no United Nations if it weren't for our leaders. They are using our military power and our financial power to bring about this world government. And I think in the process, they will destroy this country. I think that's exactly what they're doing. They're going to destroy us militarily. They're destroying our military now, destroying the faith and really the loyalty of many of our young soldiers. Fewer and fewer people are going into the military. Even the Marines can't get the number of troops that they need. So many of the people who've been in the military are getting out just as soon as they can, even with massive offers of $30,000 to re-up. But look and see what's happening financially as America's wealth is being funneled into other countries, being transferred into other countries. I think that the rulers of our country today intend to lower the living standards of the people in this country, and they don't need America anymore. Everything is in place for world government. Let's go to Rick, who's calling in from Texas. Rick, did you have a question for our guest?
Yeah.
Go ahead, speak up a little louder, please.
Have they ever seen when they've been to those meetings, have they ever seen any of the Rothschilds?
Have you ever seen any of the Rothschilds at any of the meetings you've been at?
I have not seen them personally, but at the World Economic Forum, they give us a book of all the people who attend. And Lord Rothschild has been at a number of the World Economic Forum meetings. In other words, he's registered there. His picture is in the book. But I personally have not seen him.
All right.
Would the Rockefellers do?
David Rockefeller's been there.
Okay, fine. Stevens. Anything else, Rick?
How many of those guys are there that meet at those meetings? I mean, is it thousands or hundreds?
What was that, Rock? You have to repeat that. We lost.
I heard his question. At any of the meetings, they limit it to about 2,500 people, of which there are anywhere from 1,000 to 1,100 CEOs. And then the rest come from religious NGOs, academicians.
How about banks? How about financiers?
Well, I count those in with corporations.
Okay, fine.
So we're talking about fascism here? Is it already fascist?
No, that's really what it is. It's a corporate socialist state is what they really want, with a small ruling elite. As we refer to them, the captains and the kings.
May I suggest that you buy from Dr. Stan my book, Prince Charles, the Sustainable Prince, and I think that will give you quite a heads up on what we're talking about.
And we carry that. It's an excellent book. We recommend it. Anything else, Rick?
Can you prove that he's in control of all this, though? Is there a way
can
to
I prove
that?
Yeah, there's more and more evidence all the time, yes.
Now, Rick, let me just point out that Joan talks about the meeting that was held late in 1991, early in 1992, aboard the Royal Yacht Britannia, where the Prince of Wales Business Forum held a meeting. Prince Charles called the leaders of the world together. Among them, I believe it, correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't Al Gore there? And certainly the financial and corporate leaders of the world sat down, hammered out the program that would become the Mein Kampf of the most important meeting held in the last century, and that was the Second Earth Summit in Rio in 1992, which most people never heard of. And that after the plan was hammered out, then it was presented to the delegates from all around the world at the Second Earth Summit meeting in Rio. Would that be a fair summary of what happened?
Yes.
And, of course, Prince Charles is the force behind that. So,
and it's in my book.
Right. He works behind the scenes very, very quietly. But, of course, he's far more powerful than the king or queen of England. Okay, thanks so much for calling. Let's go to Tim calling from Indianapolis. Hi, Tim.
Oh, hi, everyone. I just wanted to make a couple comments and a quick question. Another adjective to describe our government, not only criminals and felons and murders, but when you look at 9/11, you have to use the word saboteurs.
Also, okay, now did you have a question for our guest?
Well, yes. My question is, we see Twiddly D and Twiddly Dumb running around now, Bush and Clinton, and this tsunami here. Now, will the World Bank and all the UN, all these global corporations move into this orchestrated tsunami? Who will handle all the money and distribution and all that? Thank you.
Have any thoughts at all on that, Joan?
I do. If I can answer that, please. In my current report, I speculated about the whether or not the tsunami was natural or whether it was manufactured like so many things. And I quoted two different sources that talked about that it was a manufactured job. Just today, or just yesterday, I got a letter from a friend of mine in New Zealand. And let me just tell you this, and then I want to address the tsunami and the money. My friend said, unknown that I was writing this report, he said, I have included photocopies of maps of the tsunami area and Diego Garcia, the top secret British-controlled, massive U.S. Air Force base in the Indian Ocean, south of the Maldives, where up to 1970, the British Air Force were testing tsunami bombs from. I personally know a retired bomber pilot who was working on the project.
Okay.
So let me say that when I go back to the tsunami, and when I go back to the report of the reform of the United Nations, the report of the reform of the United Nations puts forth a philosophy called collective security. Collective security means that for humanitarian purposes, we have to band together for the good of the people of the world, and we have to rid the world of poverty, of famine, of disease, providing education to people, providing a better life, clean water, and it's no longer just for war. They've now expanded it into all these other reasons for humanitarian purposes. And they say that the world has so many problems, whether it's AIDS, whether it's terrorism, whether it's kids dying from HIV, AIDS, or whether it's kids who aren't being educated, that we now have to come together in an interdependent way. And so, to be honest with you, in order to come together in an interdependent way, there are things that have to occur that make us think that, oh, wow, we better come together as one and band together, in which George Bush the First called a new world order, in order to, quote-unquote, protect ourselves, when in fact we're walking into the mouth of the lion.
And, of course, all that money that they're talking about being given to those victims of the tsunami over there, and certainly these are people, poor people, that have lost everything. But we saw what happened over in Iraq. $9 billion just mysteriously disappeared. Oh, shucks, we have no idea what happened to it. It must have been poor bookkeeping. $9 billion, we don't know what happened to it. What's going to happen to all that money that's going over there for tsunami relief? No wonder Bill Clinton's got such a big smile on his face. He's got to coordinate the whole thing. Sort of like Kofi Annan's son. Anything else, Joan?
Yeah. what's happened now over in that whole area is the price of property has gone sky high. Hotels are now going in to buy for prime beachfront property.
We'll be back
out to poor people.
We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, Joan is saying that over there, where, of course, the tsunami has just washed away all the homes along the beach, now the big corporations are going to come in, they're going to buy up the property and put up their massive hotels all along the beach there. Let's go to Carol, who's calling us from Arkansas. We'll see if we can get one more call before we get to the end. Carol, did you have a question for our guest?
Just to verify something they were saying for those who were doubting, I was listening to a program this morning that had Lorraine Murray, who had worked for Lawrence Livermore nuclear laboratories out there, and they were talking about the depleted
uranium
problem, yes. And a man called in and said, well, who's really behind all this? How, you know, who is really financing the warheads and the armaments? And she very abruptly just shortly said, David Rockefeller and the Queen of England. And also to back up what they're saying, Dr. John Coleman said the very much same thing. He was in the MI5 in Great Britain, and he wrote the book, The Committee of 300, and he says the Queen is at, very much at the top of the world control. And so she's providing bullets, certainly.
All right, I think it's very interesting. Of course, behind the Queen of England is the Bank of England, probably the most important bank in the entire world, established in 1694 by Mr. William Paterson. And it was out of the pattern of the Bank of England that came the whole world central banking system that controls the governments of the world. Do you have any comment at all, Joan Vian?
I do. Thank you so much. The bottom line is I have proof that the largest contributor to the Bank of England was King William and Queen Mary.
Right. They put up the money for the Bank of England, right.
And so the bottom line is, let's not assume that that was the only bank they put money up for. And when you take a look at all the other central banks of the world, I'm sure many of the same people who funded the Bank of England also are funding all the other central banks, which makes us understand the debt and the in perpetuity and the interest income that they're receiving. It's more than just an annuity.
All right. That's a good point. Anything else, Carol?
I just would remind folks not to forget that Prescott Bush, W's grandfather, made his money off of the military armaments and actually the bullets that he sold to Hitler to shoot back at our boys in World War II.
Well, somebody had to provide the weapons to be used to kill our boys. Thanks so much, Carol.
Thank you.
And the great tragedy is most people are quite unaware of Prescott Bush, the man who sold was it Geronimo's skull and took it to the tomb there, the center of the Skull and Bones. And both his son and his grandson have been presidents of the United States.
Let me...
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when I have to remind our listeners out across America and the world that Radio Liberty, my ministry, is primarily listener-supported. We're dependent on those of you who listen to our programs and believe that we have information you're not going to get from other sources. So if you believe that, as I do, that we're involved in a spiritual battle being fought on a political, ideological, and cultural battlefield, if you believe that there are indeed dark and sinister spiritual forces that are energizing secret societies that are working with an organization, and of course today we hear all about the Council on Foreign Relations, but you go back 20 years and you go through Time Magazine and Newsweek Magazine and U.S. News and World Report and the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, you would never see mention of the Council on Foreign Relations, because this is the front for a secret society that was created by Cecil Rhodes in 1891. And this is all covered in my book, The Brotherhood of Darkness. Now, let me mention several things. First of all, we carry Joan Vian's excellent books, Global Straitjacket and Prince Charles, The Sustainable Prince. We think they're important books, and we certainly want you to go ahead and, if you'd like to know more about them, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Secondly, why we have a very, very special offer. We have an opportunity to reprint my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, at a very, very good price. And so we're going to be offering that to anybody who'd like to get an entire case at sort of a ridiculous cost. If you're interested in knowing more about getting a full case of Brotherhood of Darkness at a ridiculous cost, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. And, of course, we only have 40 that we're going to be putting out. We've already got orders for over 10 of them. And when those are gone, of course, we're going to keep the rest of the books so we can distribute them on our own. But if you'd like to know more, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. Joan Vian, I want you to put out your telephone number so people can get in touch with you, both on the women's group, which helps you to go to these meetings throughout the world, and, of course, the economic newsletter you write.
Fine. People can call 301-371-0541, 301-371-0541. We'll send you an information packet. I write two newsletters. One is geopolitical, and it's the kind of newsletter that we're discussing this evening, and the other one is an economic newsletter. So please call us for more information, because this is how this is what helps fund my activities to go to these meetings.
All right, fine. And so I think that it's important that people actually get the Joan's information. It's excellent. And remember, that she's the only person I know who goes to all these meetings. Joan Paris goes to some of the meetings with her. But Joan is a source of information on what the captains and the kings are planning for our country and for the world. And, of course, we have a real problem. We have people all across America who do not understand that we are not a democracy, we are a republic. If you read the Constitution, you will never once see the word democracy mentioned. You won't see it mentioned in the Declaration of Independence or in the Bill of Rights. You won't even see it mentioned in the Federalist Papers, other than to say that we don't want a democracy in America. Because, well, as James Madison said in the 10th of the Federalist Papers, democracies are air spectacles of turbulence and contention, are incompatible with the rights of personal property and personal security, and are usually as short in their lives as they are violent in their deaths. Unfortunately, they're teaching our children the word democracy. They're teaching our young people in college the word democracy. Our leaders keep talking about democracy, and yet, of course, as Plato had written in the Republic, democracies always descend into despotism, and that's exactly where we're headed today. A democracy is two wolves actually negotiating with a lamb on what they're going to have for dinner. In a republic, what you have is a situation where the law is against eating lambs and every lamb is armed. We'll be back in just a moment to actually pick up on the second hour of our program. And for those who are leaving us, why, please pray for America. Pray for revival, but pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. Our guest in studio this evening is Joan Paris, who, of course, has a business of her own. She's raising two children, and she's involved in all sorts of activities. Our guest from Maryland, who's on the telephone this evening, Joan Vian, of the Women's Group, and, of course, she has a business. She writes a financial newsletter. But more than that, she attends conferences. She's just back from her 7th World Economic Forum meeting. It was held over in Davos, Switzerland. And, of course, both Joan Vian and Joan Paris are well aware of the move towards the corporate socialist world that is planned for us, where the corporations, working in concert with the great financiers and a small group, really rule the world through the structure of the United Nations. And while our attention is focused on the flag-draped coffins coming back from Iraq, young men going overseas to fight for freedom, or at least believing they're fighting for freedom, we are progressively losing our freedom here at home. Of course, in the name of fighting the wicked terrorists, the Department of the Army now is collecting dossiers on every law-abiding American citizen. But, of course, they're really not spending much time trying to track down Osama bin Laden. And you mean to tell me with a $25 million, price on his head, nobody will turn him in? Yes, people have tried to turn him in, and Joel Skousen had told me people have gone to the government and said, we know exactly where he is. They're not interested in getting Osama bin Laden. They never have been. And if you doubt that, you just give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And simply ask for the Washington Times article on Osama bin Laden. It was written about the 5th or the 7th of October, 2001, just about 3 weeks after the September 11th attack, where high government officials were saying, we don't want to get Osama bin Laden. I mean, we're going into Afghanistan. If we captured Osama bin Laden or killed Osama bin Laden, how would we justify this war? And ladies and gentlemen, that's what it's all about. Same story is told in a book called Crude Politics, which we carry, by Paul Sperry, formerly the chief correspondent for WorldNet Daily in Washington, D.C. He talked to the people who came back from Iraq, the military people, pardon me, from Afghanistan, and they told him they weren't allowed to get Osama bin Laden. Paul Sperry also told me that his publisher refused to distribute his book, refuse to do anything at all. They've got 15,000 copies of the book. They'll probably have to shred them one day because they never tried to sell them. I wonder why. Could it be that they don't want the American people to know that we never tried to get Osama bin Laden because we had to have a justification for the war? Hi, we've got Bart on the line from Carmel. Bart, did you have a question for our guests?
Yes, thank you. Thank you all for what you do and bringing the information to the public. I have two quick questions for either of the two Jones. While you were there in Davos, did you hear or see or read any information about the subject of gun control?
Oh, Joan Vian, did you?
The answer is no. That topic never came up in the places that I was at.
Okay, and I had one. Thank you, and I had one other quick question.
Go ahead then.
The disarmament. Okay.
Go ahead, Joan Paris.
The disarmament policy is very deeply entrenched and in place, set up by the United Nations a long time ago. But I believe in this new report that's coming up, A More Secure World, you'll find this expanded upon. And, of course, at the last Millennium Summit also.
When guns are outlawed, only the members of representatives of the fascist world society will have guns. And hang on there. We'll be right back to you, Bart. Okay, Bart, did you have another question?
Yes, a quick one, and I'll take my answer on the air. I had heard somewhere that $5 billion of U.S. tax dollars was being spent to construct a new United Nations facility in New York, and I was wondering if there was information on that. Thank you.
That is correct. We, the taxpayers, are footing the bill because the United Nations is in the United States. Somebody has given the United Nations, I might have read who, and I don't recall at this moment, somebody has given the United Nations, while they make all these extensive repairs to the main building, they will be moved to another office building. I think it's a two-year process for this, all of this to be completed at the main building. And the bottom line is the person who's lent them the use of this office building has told them that at the end of the time when they need to move back to their newly revised building, that they can also have the building. He's donating it to them as well.
Isn't that nice? You don't remember who that is, do you, that you can give
them? No, I don't remember, and maybe it's a possibility that they didn't name it in the article, but I did read it.
All right, fine. Well, who's going to pick up here, from Joan Paris or Joan Vion?
You know, what I might do is pick up on some of the things that are proposed by the More Secure World, the Collective Security Document.
I'm glad you're doing that, Joan, because I was thinking that was the direction we needed to go.
Okay, great. And then at some point in a little bit, I wanted to really go through the inauguration speech and make some connections for people. And I know that that's not a popular thing to do, but oh well. I made a few notes from this, and this document calls for a bold new vision of collective security for the 21st century. Because, as is stated in the report, a threat to one is a threat to all.
Now, who's putting out the report?
United Nations.
Okay.
And it's a committee of people, Brent Scowcroft from the United States, Primakov, the Russian who's been hired by our government.
Isn't that nice to know that we have the former fellow, one of the most ruthless tyrants in Russia, now working here in America, working for our government, planning on how they're going to impose the dictatorship here.
It's true.
Primakov, remember that name, Primakov.
And the report outlines six clusters of threats, and those are war between the states, and that's one that, you know, I think most people commonly think of the United Nations as being involved with. The second one is violence within states. And, Joan, when we were at the Millennium Conference, this was really brought out as never before, that the United Nations was going to be intervening.
Hold on. Well, I guess this evening, Joan Paris, Joan Vion. Joan is talking about United Nations port, dealing with security. And, of course, did you say Primakov was on the board of this?
Yes.
Primakov and Brett Scowcroft, very close friend of George Bush's. But don't be surprised that Scowcroft and Primakov are working together. After all, George Herbert Walker Bush was certainly very closely related to Gorbachev. In fact, when Gorbachev's State of the Union, World State of the World Forum, you find people like old George Baker III, or you find George Shultz, assistants to or on the board of directors of Gorbachev's State of the World Forum. So it's not surprising at all. We find the communists working very closely with the capitalists, because the conflict between communism and capitalism has always been a scam. You needed an enemy so you could rally the people in this country behind our leaders. After all, why would we pay such high taxes to maintain a defense establishment that could one day be used to control the American people if it weren't that we had a foreign enemy? And now, since communism is no longer the foreign enemy, now we have a new enemy. It's called terrorism. But we still have, of course, to maintain this powerful control. All this means of monitoring the individual here in the name of preserving our freedom. Go ahead, Joan.
Well, and the second one of these six threats, the violence within states, as we became aware of this in 2000, was that the United Nations could then intervene within any country where there was any unrest that they could claim would destabilize a region. And so if there was some disturbance in the United States, they're saying that they would invade the United States. Or
they said they would invade the United States or any other state where there was unrest?
they stated that they would intervene, that they would be, yes, that they would be justified to intervene so that the peace of a region would not be destabilized. So that would be, that was their justification.
And isn't that a scream, Joan and Dr. Stan? All you have to do is look at the news. Let's see, there's problems in Pakistan, there's North Korea, there's now problems in the Philippines. I mean, and then there's Iraq, and there's Iran, and there's Afghanistan, and there's Kosovo, and there's the Congo, and we could go on, and, you know?
That's right.
And, but, of course, we've already established the fact that preemptive strikes are perfectly all right. We have a perfect right to attack any country in the world that we think we have the right to attack. But like Iraq, that was such a terrible threat to the United States because it had weapons of mass destruction, we've established the precedent. Why should we be concerned with the thought that they might attack us?
American people need to understand this concept because someday it's going to come home to roost, and it may not be that far off.
Let me take this concept that we're talking about, whereby, and Joan, you were going through the six clusters, the economic and social threats, the interstate conflict, the internal conflict, including civil war and genocide, nuclear, radiological, chemical, and biological weapons, terrorism, and transnational organizations. Don't you love that transnational organized crime?
Well, I love it because I've read the United Nations, protectionism of certain diamond cartels, of certain oil cartels, and so it's all designed to protect, you know, the global...
The corporate structure. Their
agenda and control resources, yeah, right. But I think in looking at what we are discussing and how to bring it home to roost, I basically talk about if you want to understand collective security, let's take it to the extreme. And that says that in our neighborhood, if there are several poor families that have not worked to their full capacity or they've not managed their monies well, while you and I have, what collective security says is, I should give them some percentage of my wealth because they are poor. And that all of my resources should be used to help them in the various different ways because they haven't managed their money well or they haven't had the opportunities I have or whatever. The idea is that we are not our own any longer.
That's true. And the policies that the United Nations has put in place for prevention is what they call development, and those are the United Nations Millennium Development Goals. They claim that that's the first line of defense, and that those have to be achieved, that they're the foundation of our collective security. And anyone who's interested can go to the Millennium Declaration or the Monterey Consensus to find... a synopsis of what those are. And you know, it's interesting going to Bush's speech. Joan, one of those agendas that's in the Millennium Declaration is called Freedom from Fear. We were presented a brochure at the Millennium Summit, and Freedom from Fear is a brief description of the global army. And, of course, the document from the 2000 summit was the Brahimi Report that described how this peace-building and collective security mechanism would be constructed. And if you go to the president's inaugural address, he uses those exact words. And to me, it's chilling because I know as a lifelong Republican, for somebody to sit here and tell me that my government, that my president, that people in the party that I have belonged to are at these meetings, and I've sat in the meetings and I've heard them, you know, say that you know, they're totally behind this agenda, and I know that my tax dollars have funded most of the training that goes on at these United Nations meetings. But when you read this, you're just not aware of it unless you know exactly verbatim what's in some of these documents. And I'm looking for the page where he makes this comment about the freedom from fear. But it's a direct quote. And as soon as I find that in the speech, I'll bring that out. But
now, I think that what we have to understand is that our leaders have no loyalty to America. This is the great tragedy. They have their loyalty to this internationalist idea. They can't tell the American people because they would be furious to realize that these people who swore to uphold our Constitution are intent upon betraying it. But that's what this is really all about. The creation of a new world order and a new world religion and the destruction of America's national sovereignty, the destruction of the prosperity of our nation, the impoverishment of our people.
Paragraph 29, by making every citizen an agent of his or her own destiny, we will give our fellow Americans greater freedom from want and fear. And that was one of the other development goals, freedom from want, freedom from fear. And he uses the exact words. And the reason the president or whoever's written his speech has done that is because these are buzzwords to the insiders, to the members of the New World Order, to him, to signal to them that, yes, I'm on the track. This is your agenda. Yes, I'm going to be implementing it. And that's why you find these exact phrases. Another thing that was very interesting to me in this speech, and whoever wrote it again, was toying with those who were familiar with a book that was written by the head librarian of the
Fire in the Minds of Men by James Billington.
Paragraph 23. It says, by our efforts, we have lit a fire as well, a fire in the minds of men. And that's exactly the title of his book.
Right.
And that book describes concepts that came out of the French Revolution and that were picked up upon by Lenin and Marx that, you know, overthrew the order, and it brought in a new world order. And it talks about the occult, and there's mention, I believe, of the Illuminati. And so to an insider, it's very interesting to see these signals being placed into the speech.
Well, you know, again, we go back to the fact that Bush is skull and bones. Many of the people throughout the U.S. government are not only skull and bones, but they're Council for Foreign Relations, Trilateral Commission, they are Rhodes Scholars, you know, the whole gambit here. And they're always using a coded language that has meaning to them. And what is so incredible is that when you speak their language and you understand their phraseology, and then you use it back on them, it blows their mind.
Exactly. They look at you cross-eyed like, well, how do you know? Where'd you get
that?
Oh,
they want to run. or they spill their guts. They're so shocked.
Exactly.
Because you're able to use their own terminology back on them, and they don't know what to do because they really think you and I are deaf, dumb, stupid, and tuned out.
In fact, Billington does talk about, he says, the radical Bavarian Illuminists urged in the early 1780s that his secularizing reforms be carried even further through an imminent revolution of the human mind. And isn't that exactly what the bringing in of this new world order is all about? It's a secularizing revolution.
Well, I think that people have to understand that the James H. Billington, the librarian of Congress, member of the Council on Foreign Relations, truly an intellectual, understands the occult origin of everything that's going on today.
Well, let me ask you, Dr. Stan, I've always wondered, he wrote this book, he's a member of the Council for Foreign Relations, do you think he's, how do I put this delicately?
John, you never put anything delicately, just go for it.
Go ahead.
You think he agrees with the agenda?
Oh, I think he
absolutely. And he's just a sympathizer for us poor, stupid fools?
I believe that he is an elitist. I think he knows exactly what's going on. I think he's an excellent historian. He tells you, of course, that the Illuminati never came to the United States. That's strange because I got to his office something we carry in our ministry. It's called the Clintonian Illuminati. Expose of the Clintonian Illuminati, written in 1803. So if the Illuminati didn't come to the United States, why, how could he write that, how could he say the Illuminati wasn't here? No, he's concealing, in my opinion, part of what he knows, but he is telling us that the origin of this whole world revolution is the occult. Well, Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at the Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening in studio, Joan Vian, and of course Joan Paris, and of course on the telephone coming in from Maryland is Joan Vian. And Joan was simply asking about James H. Billington, the Librarian of Congress, who's written a wonderful book, which everybody in the listening audience should read, called Fire in the Minds of Men. And James H. Billington's whole thrust is this. Most people honestly believe that what's going on in the world today and the world revolutionary movement has something to do with the Enlightenment, has to do with the writings of Voltaire and Rousseau. And James Billington's point is simply that is not so. The world revolutionary movement that began with the American Revolution in 1776 and the French Revolution in 1789 and culminated with the Russian Revolution in 1917 and the Cuban Revolution in 1959 had its origin in the occult. And as he said, it originated when the aristocrats of Europe took their lighted candles off of Christian altars and moved them onto Masonic altars. And then he traces the course of the secret societies that dominated Europe during the 19th century and of course still had an influence during the early years of the 20th century when communism was established. He tries to convince his readers that this influence never came to America, but of course we know that it did. We have the writings of people affiliated with the Clintonian Illuminati and other organizations here in the United States in the early 1800s. But, of course, the elite in America cannot allow the American people to realize that these occult influences were here and in the early 1800s. They are here at the highest levels of our government today. And when we find two members of a secret society that came out of a secret Bavarian society in 1832, and I'm speaking of Skull and Bones, when we find them running two of their men for the presidency in the year 2004, one being Senator John Kerry, the other being President George W. Bush, whose father was a member of Skull and Bones, whose grandfather was a member of Skull and Bones, and of course John Kerry is a member of Skull and Bones, and his wife is one of the richest women in America. There's something wrong with the picture. I think they're simply flaunting their power and saying, we know the American people are too stupid to recognize what's really going on in the world today. Does that answer your question, Joan?
Yeah, it does. Thank you very much.
And don't you carry that book, Dr. Stan?
We do. We have it available through Radio Liberty. And we think it's certainly one of the five most important books in my library, or six most important books. No.
You know, Joan Vian, would you address this, because I know you addressed this in your last newsletter also about the Commonwealth, but a friend said, I hope you talk about how poverty had to be created and, to bring out the connection, how terrorism is rooted in poverty, and then that all ties into sustainable development, and that ties into the Earth Charter.
But is terrorism really rooted? I mean, after all, certainly Osama bin Laden is not poor. Many of the people with him have college graduates who come from the elite over there in the Middle East, so this idea that terrorism is rooted in poverty, I think, is really sort of like communism is rooted in poverty. It never was. It was always a movement of the elite, just as terrorism is a movement of the very powerful and the very elite.
I believe it's a movement of the elite, and a lot of poverty has been created. The Bible says the poor will always be with us, but again, as with this whole agenda, this elite takes everything and perverts it.
Right.
The poverty has been created by these Bretton Woods institutions that go in and take the natural resources and impoverish and all of the resources then go to pay these dummy projects and leave the people impoverished. But we've been brainwashed into believing and people are taught that poverty creates crime. And there was this landmark case where these two young men, wealthy young men, said, having been taught the Darwinian theory of evolution, that we're simply predators, and they went out and found an overweight boy and killed him. No malice, no anger, no nothing, but just, we're predators because we're the product of evolution.
Leopold of Rome.
And that was a landmark decision.
Right.
which is in our courts today, that teaches that, and so the UN is using in that same, because it's been bought by public in general. Nobody questions that anymore, that we have to change the environment so that we don't have crime. And that's the argument that's being used here. You're absolutely right, but it's been perverted, and that's how it's being used.
And I think there was a story, I think it was Leopold and Loeb, there were two very wealthy people who just decided to kill somebody so they could kill them.
Right.
No reason at all, just right. Because, of course, they had the ability to do it. And it was quite a spectacular case. It may be, 50 years ago, a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, this sort of thing goes on today.
Exactly.
Let me go back to, I think it is so important when we talk about Africa. I am in the process of doing research. It'll take a little while because I have many research projects, but when we take a look at the whole idea of transfer of wealth, the whole idea of the Millennium Development Goals, which will demand more of our taxpayer dollars, at the World Economic Forum, the concept of global taxation was raised again by President Jacques Chirac as a tax for the poor. And so many of the people there thought it was a great idea. Of course, George Soros liked the idea of a tax on airline tickets. That's easy, quick, simple, he said. Former President Clinton said, the world's never had a global tax. I don't think it'll work. It'll take too long. It'll have to be approved by every parliament. And so really the idea was, I think, the old Hegelian dialectic where you throw out something really radical in order for people to say, well, hey, wait a minute, let's just raise what every state is giving currently to the Overseas Development Assistance, ODA, for poor countries. Let's just raise that to a certain level, and that will then fund the Millennium Development Goals. So that is we already have a form of taxation that is going on through Overseas Development Assistance, but of course, in the eyes of the United Nations, we're not giving enough, and they're calling on the United States to raise our overseas development assistance from 0.2 of gross national product to 0.7, which would be an additional $55 billion a year of our taxpayer dollars to meet the Millennium Development Goals of reducing poverty and hunger in the world, but specifically in Africa. So let's take a look at Africa. I have been told that Africa has enough resources, and I'm not talking the diamonds and the copper and the gold that is found all over Africa. I'm specifically talking the ability by way of natural resource, agricultural resources, whereby they could grow their own food and they wouldn't be a burden on anyone. And so in doing my research for my last newsletter on the Commonwealth, if people want to call and request the newsletter on the Commonwealth as well as this current newsletter, I'm not sure I can give out the price, but the bottom line is I can't give it to you because obviously it's my time and my effort. So you'll have to make a donation to the women's group. But with regard to this whole idea of the perpetual poor, that's what has been perpetuated in Africa, and primarily through World Bank loans for developmental projects that became white elephant loans. 80% of them became white elephants, then leaving these countries with huge loans that they can't pay back to the World Bank.
And it was done intentionally. It wasn't done accidentally. It was done intentionally to impoverish those people. The people of Africa have been targeted for destruction, unfortunately, in my opinion, by the elite that run the world. We'll be right back in just a moment here, and I'll be glad to talk to Kurt, who's calling from Rio del Mar. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and we have Kurt calling us from Rio Del Mar. Hi, Kurt. Did you have a question for our guest?
It's actually a comment. They had talked about coded words. Back in 1985, I was offered the department chair of a New Age college. And when I started realizing what it was, I'd be in meetings with the owner of the college, and he would teach me at lunch how to talk in code, where I'd have a conversation with one person, but my real conversation was with another person in the room with coded words. And he was saying how I had to learn that. And I called Connie Cumbie up, and I said, you know, this is what's going on. What do I do? And she said, you're the one person, you know, as a Christian, you're the one person on campus that would be teaching the kids the truth, right? And I said, oh, don't tell me that, Connie. And I got off the phone, and I started thinking about it, and I realized something. You know, we are Christians. We have to know who we are in Christ.
Amen.
And that college was for sale. It was in the Monterey Bay area. It was down in the Monterey area. And they had their campus for sale, and they were buying another campus, Stan,
yep,
in SoCal.
Okay.
And so what I did was I said, hold it. I don't really want to be chair of a New Age college, but yet, you know, I would be a very strong evangelical Christian on the staff. So I said, okay. I got down and I prayed. And I begged the Lord to give me an answer. Now, the both properties went in escrow. The one in the Monterey area went through escrow and he got his money. And the one in Santa Cruz fell through. And I've been department chair of a college that hasn't had a campus since 1985.
Okay, fine, Kurt. Well,
that's the power we have in Christ, and we need to use it.
Amen to that. Thanks for the story, Kurt.
Yeah, bye now.
Absolutely,
bye-bye.
Kurt. Absolutely. That is so powerful. You're absolutely right. We need to know who we are in Christ. We need to trust God. We need to know, and this is something that I've been learning myself. He's not the little God. He's the big God. I mean, you know, and watch him. Watch him orchestrate. But in order for that to happen, we have to know how to pray, and we have to understand the agenda. And part and parcel of what we're doing on radio, part and parcel of all the time that I spend researching, I mean, this is laborious, as you know, research. And what helps me is that I spent 2 years understanding the coded words. It took me that long to figure out how to read their documents. And so now, with this understanding and with helping people who are listening to the radio...
Hold that thought, Joan. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, Joan Vian, and, of course, Joan Paris. And Joan Vian is just saying that there is sort of a secret method of speaking, speaking in code. And of course, when you understand what the coded messages are, you can interpret what they're saying, and you can even learn how to speak their language and speak back to them. And then they think, of course, you're one of them. And of course, you learn to read. I mean, much of their writing is written with the code words and code phrases. And once we can do this, fine. But the average individual, when they hear these people talking about freedom and democracy, they honestly think they want freedom and democracy. Know what they're really talking about is a system by which every aspect of our lives will be controlled.
And so by understanding all of this, we then have the power to move mountains in our prayers, because it is the effective, fervent prayer of a righteous man that avails much.
Amen to that.
And in fact, in Bush's speech, the way he calls all of the nations of the world together in this collective security is... he said that division among free nations is a primary goal of freedom's enemies. He says the concerted effort of free nations to promote democracy is a prelude to our enemies' defeat. The concerted effort of nations, that's the collective security. And, you know, Joan, going back to what we were talking about in Africa, when we were at the 2002 follow-up to that 92 Earth Summit in Johannesburg, we were invited to a press briefing with Colin Powell, and afterwards we spoke to our ambassador to South Africa and another gentleman there, and they had been discussing the Congo Basin Forest Partnership, which is the United States.
That was John Taylor, I believe. Undersecretary John Taylor.
Turner.
Turner.
Turner,
yep.
Turner, yep. And I asked them a question. I said, is this a debt for equity swap? And they were caught off guard, turned to one another, and they thought, okay, we're out of the bag. And they said, well, we don't have it completely structured yet, but yes, this is a debt for equity swap, meaning all of this debt that has been incurred in the Congo Basin forest region, which what you spoke of is this amazing, incredible wealth of timber and water and minerals and genetic resource material, is all been locked up now to, and it will, who was there was the head of the United States Timber Association, paper products. They will be allowed to go in, and in exchange for the debt of the South Africans, we'll forgive that, but we're taking their resources.
And, of course, this is exactly the story that John Perkins tells in his excellent book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman. That's the subject of my January newsletter, which we'll be glad to send to any of our listeners if they give us a call of 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. The January newsletter explains how we, of course, send economic hitmen into these countries to beguile their leaders and, of course, to bribe their leaders and then seize control of their natural resources. We carry the book, Confessions of Economic Hitman, and we will have a four-tape set based upon my interviews with Mr. John Perkins available very soon if you'd like to order it. So right now we've got Jack calling from Michigan. Jack, did you have a quick question?
Well, the codified jargon was exemplified in Junior Luciferian's original inaugural speech, which I hadn't intended to hear, but serendipitously caught the very sentence toward the end where he says there's still an angel in the whirlwind directing the storm. That was the original inaugural speech.
Oh, wow.
And then subsequently, when they began to create the axis of evil prior to Persian Gulf 2, he did say that this is the new crusade.
Okay, fine. Do you have a question for our guest?
Yeah, in fact, the United Nations, which appears as the infrastructure for the Communist Manifesto's manifestation,
yep,
seems to be predicated upon the bankruptcy of the United States.
Yes.
Which, if I'm not mistaken, please correct me if I'm wrong, is actually being administered through the Bank of England by the BAR hierarchy.
Well, it's really being, of course, administered to our own leaders, economic leaders, who seem intent upon redistributing the wealth of the American people, as it says in the Earth Charter, point number 10. And incidentally, if you don't have a copy of the Earth Charter, we'll get you one through Radio Liberty. But certainly, this whole thing is being orchestrated, whether it's being orchestrated by the Bank of England or by the central banks of the world. Let's not pit it on one organization. It may be the Bank of England. It may be all the central banks. But certainly, the financial leaders of the world are working in concert to preside over the destruction of the economy of our country. Anything else, Jack?
Well, yes. In fact, that was very eloquently stated, Dr. Stan. The point I'm attempting to make here is it appears that the minions at the from the global to local level, I would say virtually all the U.S. senators are bar attorneys or esquires, as are most all of the administrators of this democratic system, which, when I checked in the library, democracy, according to Harold T. Lasky, world-renowned communist, is essentially synonymous with communism. So here we have this international group of esquires, I-bar and then the A-bar. What are they doing?
Okay, fine. We'll get a little bit too far off subject there, Jack. But right now I think it's important that we understand we're moving towards a world fascist system. Whether you want to call it communism, whether you want to call it fascism, doesn't matter what you call it. What it is the loss of individual freedom.
And, you know, I'm looking at a speech that President Bush gave in Mexico at the Financing for Development conference, which was just a 6 months prior to the 2002 summit, not millennium, but the Earth Summit in Africa, and in that speech, he again he's talking about the fight against global poverty, and he says that that's the hope, is and it's an answer to terror. So it's just it's something that's being built upon over years, and our government is fully behind this agenda. And if you go again to President Bush's inaugural address, he talks about liberty for all does not mean independence from one another. So here he's reinforcing this collective security through a forced servitude. And he says, now he says, we're going to extend this vision by reforming great institutions to serve the needs of our time. Bush is talking about reforming the United Nations. So he's speaking to certain members of his audience saying, yes, I'm with you. We're participating in this new order. In fact, in one of the concluding paragraphs, he states that we have confidence because freedom is the permanent hope of mankind. Here he's talking about freedom again. He talks about the hunger in dark places and the longing of the soul. When our founders declared a new order of the ages, and here's that homage to his new world order, when soldiers died in wave upon wave for a union based on liberty, when citizens marched in peaceful outrage under the banner Freedom Now, they were acting on an ancient hope that is meant to be fulfilled. And there you're referencing back to the fire in the minds of men, the Illuminati, the occult forces that drive this whole agenda.
Well, of course, I would think perhaps he's referring to this ancient plan of the secret societies. In fact, there have been, since the beginning of time, a plan, an ancient plan. Babylon, certainly ancient Egypt, Alexander the Great. The secret societies and the mystery religions have always had this ancient plan. I'm amazed. Who is actually making that statement? Is that the president?
This is the president. I'm reading from his inaugural address.
He's talking from that ancient plan?
Yes.
Okay.
Wait, Jack? Hold it. Hello? You who?
I think Jack is...
Jack's gone?
Is gone.
Jack
is
gone.
Let me say with regard to the point that Jack was making... When, in my opinion, when you have capitalism with no values and no morals and no honesty and no integrity, in my opinion, that leads to communism, because communism is ruled by force, you know? And I look at capitalism without values and morals as a shell of communism. And so I also understand that there are some evolutionary processes between capitalism and communism, but I do see that capitalism without morals and integrity becomes as corrupt as communism for control.
Joan, are you there?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
So that's the point I wanted to make to his response, that I think there is an evolutionary process that is going on in the world, and communism has a philosophy of evil, and I think it all goes back to, as you have said, Dr. Stan, all of the occult. I mean, this is what we're looking at. If we could maybe rephrase it and say that communism is the working through of the occult doctrine in a political manner.
Okay, we've got Maggie calling to us from Texas. And hi, Maggie, did you have a question for our guest? Maggie, are you there? Maggie, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Go ahead.
Yes, for Ms. Vian, I've heard you on several previous interviews, though not this one, say something to the effect that you would give some advice or some kind of verbal help to people who might be interested in going to conventions on their own, paying their own way, and getting credentialed somewhere.
Yes.
Now, I'm interested in that. I can't afford to go to places like Davos, but I gather that there are some not quite so high-powered, but still important conferences closer to home.
Oh, absolutely. There's tons of them going on.
Well, Maggie, could I suggest that you call Joan? Why don't you put out your telephone number?
Yes, once more.
301-371-0541.
Yes, okay. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye, Maggie. Yes. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye. Sure.
Okay, fine. Well, maybe you'll have somebody there keep you company at the meetings. Go ahead, Joan.
Anyway, so I think we have there are many evolutions going on, and obviously we're being moved away from a Christian base here in America and from our Constitution. And they're doing this, as you know, step by step, rule by rule, law by law, and as we now see, war by war. So, you know, they're moving us away. The Christians in America are dumbed down, and they're tuned out, and they have forgotten that our purpose in the world is not to be in a permanent Disneyland, but that you know, we are to occupy and we are to stand in the gap. So, you know, because the church is out to lunch, you know, there's a very strong movement, very powerful evolutionary forces of Satan moving us away.
Well, our churches are being co-opted, and our Christian schools are being co-opted because they are adopting this secular business management style of governance, and it is totally neutralized any effect that Christians might have, because they are the ones that need to stand in the gap. If my people who are called by my name would turn from their wicked ways and humble themselves, pray and seek my face, I will heal their land. It's not happening. And we have nothing to blame but, well, ourselves, our churches, the lack of pastoral leadership, the total absence of the pastors in this battle.
You know, speaking of pastors, I have a friend who's an expert in communism, and he told me in interviewing, I forget what important communist, that man told him, you know, the seminaries were easy. He said, we never thought they would fall so fast and so quick, but they did.
No, that's the story that, of course, Colonel Lavon Ray tells about, and David Horowitz told him that they had infiltrated the seminaries and taken them over. So, go ahead.
You know, I'd like to make one connection for our listeners. There's a piece of legislation that you can be watching for so that you can see how this collectivist security agenda is being implemented. It's a bill that was introduced July 11th of 2001, and it's H.R. 2459 to establish a Department of Peace. We can look for this to be reintroduced in the 2005-2006 time frame again, according to the Thomas site on the Internet to look at this. It's a really brief bill. It was introduced by Dennis Kucinich, Sam Farr here of the Monterey Bay area, people that are the real movers and shakers behind the implementation of the Sustainable Development Agenda. And this Department of Peace, the mission of the department shall hold peace as an organizing principle, coordinating service to every level of American society. It calls for an institution that would basically replace and be on the same, you know, to be established on the same order of our military service academies, and this would be a peace academy, and it would be a four-year course of instruction in peace education. And you know, and this might sound a little ridiculous, but the legislation is being put out there. It's being very, very organized. You'll find Palo Alto, there's a group next week. All over the state, they have very highly coordinated groups that are promoting this and working to get it implemented. And if you go to this collective security document, you find out that the United Nations also, right, Joan, is implementing this peace commission, brand new. So, you know, we find these things mirror imaged in the legislation.
Give me the number, Joan, of that bill again.
It is H.R. 2459.
And you're telling me that if you go to thomas.gov,
Damas.
Plug that in, it'll tell us where it's at.
Exactly. Right. You can get all the status and who sponsored it. And
I'd like to talk for a moment about Dennis Kucinich.
Go ahead.
He was at the meeting in South Africa, and he was partnering with the Gorbachev Foundation to sponsor some bills in Congress. And I find it, I interviewed somebody from his office in South Africa, and I find it absolutely fascinating that a number of our farmers that I've talked to when he was running for president or trying to run thought that he was the most conservative person on the earth.
Hold up the thought for just a moment, Joan. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening, Joan Vian, Joan Paris. We're just about out of time. Joan, you were just saying that many of the farmers felt that Dennis Kucinich was a very conservative individual. Of course, he's a radical leftist. He's part of this whole internationalist movement.
Absolutely. And that's my whole point, that, you know, he's partnered with the Gorbachev Foundation and all the things Joan Paris said. And, you know, yet there are many people who are gravely concerned about land rights, and they were supporting Dennis Kucinich.
Well, and Bush in his speech in Monterrey, Mexico, talks about nations closing their markets, and of course the global community has been hammering on the United States to drop any protection of our agriculture. And if our dear precious farmers, I don't care how much money they make, we cannot destroy our agriculture in this nation. And I'll tell you what, they're on the chopping block. They're slated for extermination.
Oh, absolutely, and the group of eight is going to go after that in July.
In fact, right now that we're withdrawing the agricultural subsidies under the pressure from the internationalists, and our farmers are not going to be able to work to compete effectively with the farmers of South America, who will not have all the restrictions, and soon Argentina and Brazil will be competing with our farmers. Thank you.
I'm going to go to the hospital.